today on Earth Eats. In part three of Harvest Public Media's series Watching Our Water, we hear why cleaning up Iowa's water depends on voluntary actions from farmers. I'm Annie Corrigan. Also today, we meet Mary Figueroa, who returns to the world of competitive gingerbread houses after being ridiculed for her hobby as a kid. And Daniel Orr does persimmon pudding, and Lisa Dorzeski of Rainbow Bakery does donut glaze. Let's hear what's up with the news this week. Here's Mark Chilla.
Starting off today, Annie, with some good news for pollinators. Seven species of bees native to Hawaii are now listed as endangered by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The endangered status will allow authorities to get funding and implement programming to help protect the bees. The rule also gives protected status to 39 plant species found on the islands and to three other animals native to Hawaii. Also, a coalition of farm groups is trying to scuttle a proposal from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency that would increase restrictions on the herbicide atrazine. Some research indicates that atrazine could be more dangerous at low levels than previously thought, with links to birth defects and cancer. The American Farm Bureau Federation argues that lowering allowable levels of atrazine would hurt the environment because it's needed for so-called conservation tillage, where farmers plow the previous year's crop residue, like corn stalks or wheat stubble, into the fields to prevent soil erosion and runoff. But environmental groups have long been pushing for a ban on the weed killer. Atrazine in runoff has been linked to other environmental damage, like stunted development and disrupted hormones in animals. The EPA has not evaluated the chemical since the last time it was up for review in 2003. Public comment on the proposed atrazine risk assessment closed on Wednesday this week. Another report is due out later this year that will focus on atrazine's effect on human health. The FDA has begun the process of redefining the term healthy on food labels. The FDA is taking into account all of the newer evidence linking excessive sugar intake to heart disease and obesity. Policymakers are looking for input from food makers, health experts, and the public. We've posted a link where you can submit comments to the FDA on our website. That's eartheats.org. And restaurants are serving fewer and fewer people. Some analysts say the restaurant industry is headed for a recession, or at least challenging times in the near future. But the numbers are a bit confusing. According to the USDA, dining out surpassed home cooking in 2014, but there are hints that this trend may soon reverse itself. Data from January and June of this year show people spent more money in supermarkets than in restaurants. And while the National Restaurant Association estimates that sales will increase 5% this year, the growth rate of those sales has slowed since 2007. And sales increases are affected by an increase in prices. Read more about these stories at eartheats.org.
Chad Bouchard and Taylor Killow write for the blog. Mark Chilla brings us the headlines.
See you next week.
Excess fertilizer and pesticides have flowed from farm fields into our waterways for years. While federal regulations have successfully cut back some water pollution, they have little muscle in combating one of the Midwest's biggest environmental problems. As part of Harvest Public Media's series Watching Our Water, Amy Mayer reports.
Roger Zylstra stops his red GMC Sierra and tromps into a ditch.
Here is one of the tile. That's where it outlets.
He points to a pipe, maybe 6 to 8 inches in diameter. Water that drains from his farm fields collects in pipes like this one and travels underground until it finally drips out, here, into a road culvert. This water is called runoff.
If you come here after a heavy rain, do you see it really pouring out?
Yeah, it would have a lot more water in it.
Farm runoff like this can contain harmful chemicals, nitrates from fertilizer the plants don't absorb, or excess pesticides. You might think a landmark environmental law like the Clean Water Act would force farmers or landowners to prevent that kind of pollution, the way it bars factories from dumping toxins into rivers. But the Clean Water Act has no power to stop agricultural runoff. Farm groups have vocally opposed regulation, fearing it will impose specific conservation requirements across the board. While they have urged farmers to do better, voluntary measures so far are having a limited impact.
That was where the rye cover was.
Zylstra raises hogs and grows corn and soybeans. In an effort to improve soil health, he also planted a cover crop here. These off-season plants also keep potential toxins out of the water. He recognizes that
if we don't learn how to be better stewards of the soil and water, that we're going to end up regulated.
The use of cover crops has expanded widely in recent years, but the amount of farmland potentially sending unwanted chemicals downriver has exploded. Since the Clean Water Act was passed in 1972, the number of acres growing corn and soybeans in this country has increased by more than 50%. And the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico, blamed in part on pollution from Midwest farm runoff, has grown. In response, several Midwest states, including Iowa, have created nutrient reduction strategies to help clean up the water.
There's nothing about it that's enforceable.
That's Neil Hamilton, director of the Agricultural Law Center at Drake University in Des Moines. Iowa's plan is voluntary, and Hamilton says, while it's long on science and goals, it's very thin on implementation.
The nutrient reduction strategy has also had the political effect or benefit, depending on where you sit, as being able to try to delay or defer conversations about other things.
Things, Hamilton says, like implementing a sales tax increase to fund water quality projects. Iowa voters approved one in 2010, but it's still not in place. The Des Moines Water Utility has sued upriver drainage districts, alleging they've allowed pollutants from farm fields to poison public waters. Hamilton says the suit raises real legal questions, but no court decision will make the water cleaner.
We aren't going to be able to litigate our way there.
Companies have joined farm nonprofits and state and federal governments to offer money to farmers so they will try cover crops and other techniques to reduce runoff. The example of these early adopters can be a powerful tool to push other farmers to try new conservation practices.
Hi.
Hi, Amy.
Come on in.
Bryce Engbers is Roger Zylstra's neighbor and farming partner.
I get to see all of his data from our yield monitor. We share a combine together. So we're keeping a very close eye on how it's working.
Engber says he likes what he's seen from his neighbor's cover crops. He's trying some too, but he also points out that farming is cleaner than it was decades ago.
I'm polluting much, much less than what I ever did before.
He has made changes, particularly with livestock and manure management. But advocates for water quality insist comparisons to yesteryear aren't the point. The point is to hit agreed-upon goals to reverse the current problems. And repeatedly, the Midwest's voluntary approach has failed to do that. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
Next week in Part 4, chemical runoff doesn't just come from farms. We'll go to Kansas City for that story. This next story is about Christmas. Okay, hang on. I know it's not even Halloween yet. But if you want to enter gingerbread house contests in December, you have to start planning now. The deadline to enter the Connor Prairie Gingerbread House Contest is November 11th, and they're holding a how-to session the week before. I remembered this story from our archives. It aired last year. It was by reporter Matt Peterson. He introduces us to Mary Figueroa, an award-winning gingerbread house maker who's had an up-and-down relationship with the hobby.
Mary Figueroa was feeling awesome. Her house is beautiful, everybody is telling her so. But now, moments before the winners of the competition are announced, she's starting to see all the flaws. She can't stand still and keeps looking at the exit like she's gonna make a break for it.
Well, I'm nervous, for one, because I wanna win, obviously. And I mean, I think I have a pretty good house, but there are some things I didn't love about it.
Like the chimney, for example. She couldn't get some pieces to fit quite the way she wanted them to. This is her third time entering the Connor Prairie Gingerbread House competition. She wants to think she has it in the bag.
I mean, I've been really cocky about it too, so hope that doesn't bite me in the ass.
Everybody's winners. You guys do such a great job. Okay, for individual adult for first place, we have...
But let's back up for a minute. We're in Mary's bedroom near the IU campus. It feels like we're in a different era. There are retro posters on the wall, as well as a homemade collage of movie stars from years gone by. The smell of gingerbread lingers in the air. She remembers her first gingerbread house that she made in elementary school.
I have like a picture of me and my mom and this like little gingerbread house that I made in second grade probably. And I remember like my mom being really creative when making this house and like using a sucker as like a lamp post or something. And I just thought that was like the coolest thing ever.
A few years later, she started volunteering at Connor Prairie Living History Museum as a child reenactor. That was the first time she was exposed to the gingerbread house competition.
So I'd kind of look around a bit and I thought it would be kind of fun to get some friends together just to enter the contest for fun.
She entered her first competition as a freshman in high school. And by her senior year, she placed second in the teen division at the National Gingerbread House Competition in 2012. But she kept quiet about it.
Everyone thought it was really bizarre and weird. I even had like a teacher who like kind of made fun of me about it, like in a joking way. But, you know, he would do that in front of this whole class. And then everybody was like, oh, this girl is weird. There was also a really weird article that was posted about me in the newspaper and then another article in our yearbook. And both of them were just really bad and made me sound just pretty insane about gingerbread houses. So I kind of stopped telling people that I made gingerbread houses in high school, and it was just like my secret hobby.
And when Mary got to college, she had to put gingerbread houses completely on hold because it was logistically impossible.
In the dorms, I didn't have a place to make them. And then my sophomore year, my kitchen wasn't very big, but this year I have a really nice kitchen and no excuse not to, so trying to get back into it.
Hey, Mary.
Hey.
We're going back to Connor Prairie. The gingerbread house is in the trunk.
I've been awake like at least 48 hours, I think, now. I don't know. It's done.
She dropped the house off on a Friday and waited 4 long days to hear the results. Hers is one of 30 houses in the competition this year. Mary and her family take up an entire row of folding chairs. The announcer is at the podium.
Okay, for individual adult for first place, we have Mary Figueroa.
I just won! I'm just kidding. I just won! Yeah, I'm pretty excited. I don't know, I was like pretty nervous.
She won first place in the individual adult category, her first ever win at the Connor Prairie competition. And she also won most traditional, which was unexpected.
Now I'm just excited to go see some houses. I'm going to Disney World!
She runs back into the reception hall victorious. She back in the game for good? You betcha. For Earth Eats, I'm Matthew Peterson.
Pictures of Mary and her winning gingerbread house on our website. Coming up, 2 recipes from 2 different kitchens, both using persimmons.
It's otherworldly to me in a way that I can't really describe. It's like super earthy, but also sweet and complex. I honestly feel like a Greek goddess when I eat them a little bit, like I should be wearing a little crown.
Lisa Dorazeski of Rainbow Bakery. Persimmons taste great, make you feel special, but man, are they hard to turn into donut glaze. Before that, Daniel Orr levels up a traditional persimmon pudding with some shredded sweet potato. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated. Now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington, independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And from Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets. From vegetarian to paleo and low carb, taste matters. Your taste. Current truck location is available at whereisurgent.com.
All right.
Hey, hey.
Hey, Earth Eats. How you doing?
Pretty good. Look at those little perfect, pristine persimmons.
You know, persimmon trees can pop up just about anywhere that you know, a bird can poop. These are the little persimmons. These are actually from a bank parking lot in downtown Bloomington. If you pick them too early, they'll sometimes have kind of a allium kind of feel in your mouth, and it's very, very dry. So you want to be careful to taste them, make sure that they're super sweet. So what you do is they have these little crowns on them. And all you have to do is pop those off. And then the rest of the persimmon can be run through a food mill. And what we're going to do today is we're going to make, from the pulp, we're going to make a pudding. So we're going to start by adding our persimmon puree, 4 whole eggs. Okay, and then we've got our buttermilk, which we have 2 cups of buttermilk. Okay, and I just like that slightly acidic flavor that the buttermilk gives it. We have some dark rum. And then we have some vanilla extract, which we have 2 teaspoons. Okay, we're gonna add a little bit of salt, which brings out all the flavors, and a pinch of pepper. A lot of people don't think of putting pepper in desserts, but it kind of hits you in a different place on the tongue and makes it even more special. And then we're going to add our leaveners, which are our baking soda and baking powder. We're gonna add both brown sugar and granulated sugar, a cup of each. Okay, finally we're going to add sweet potato that I was talking about, and we're gonna add some melted butter. In the recipe, I call for some black walnuts. They're really, really intensely flavored, and I love them. Some people think that they're a little bit strong, but for us real Hoosiers, we like our black walnuts.
Do you get those locally?
Actually, they're from the backyard at my mother's house.
So really local.
Yeah. Okay, now we're going to add the flour. And you're going to see that that's going to kind of bring the whole thing together, and it's a fairly loose batter. All right, here we go. We're gonna pop it in the pan.
Oven at 325.
Put that in there, and we'll see you in an hour and a quarter, buddy.
Poof, it's ready.
There he is. I'm just going to spoon a nice little dollop of this out. Okay, and we're gonna have this with a little bit of vanilla ice cream.
And a generous drizzle of maple syrup. This stuff is rich, so you might find you wanna cut the pudding into individual pieces and freeze them for later. Daniel has another persimmon pudding recipe you can try out at eartheats.org. This year was a very good year for growing wheat, but that means it was a very bad year for wheat farmers on the Great Plains. There's a glut on the market, and wheat prices are hitting 13-year lows. For Harvest Public Media, Brian Thompson has been looking into what that means for the farm economy.
First, a disclosure. Technically, I'm one of those hurting wheat farmers. I recently inherited a small patch of cropland homesteaded by my great-grandfather near McCracken, Kansas, about half an hour southwest of Hayes. I don't farm it myself. Daryl North does that.
In fact, to start out, farm your land with your grandfather, Ralph, and handed it down, I guess, your father, Ken, and then, of course, you're here now, so we're farming for you. So it's been several years.
With timely rains, we got approximately 50 bushels per acre this year, which is unusually good for that piece of ground. Yields were high all through the Great Plains, and much of the world, for that matter. Sounds like a good thing, but really, that means oversupply. As harvest got underway in June, the price of wheat began plummeting. It fell to about $2.50 a bushel by the end of August and has stayed below $3 ever since. North is grateful for the bountiful harvest, but he says it takes a lot of grain at these prices to cover his costs for things like fuel, fertilizer, and chemicals.
You know, this price is 30, 40 years ago prices, and of course, we know what things cost then compared to today, so that really makes it tough.
So how does a farmer like North cope with tough times?
Definitely not buying any new stuff, no new machinery. Of course, we need repairs, and you just buy what you need, but you just really try to get by on what you got.
That's not good news for guys like Alan Fabriches. He's the corporate sales manager for Carrico Implement, a John Deere dealership with 3 stores in north central Kansas. His stores are sitting on a combined inventory of $25 to $30 million in new and used farm equipment. Fabriches expects sales this year to be 30 to 40% lower than during what he calls the record-busting years of 2012 through 2014.
Business is different than it was a few years ago. The climate has changed, and you know we're still finding ways to keep up the business, but it's obviously dropped off.
Fabriches says the company's been able to avoid layoffs. They're shifting their focus away from equipment sales and more toward parts and service.
You know, we constantly are doing promotions to try to get folks to think ahead on those repairs that, you know, rather than breaking down in harvest, let us look at it ahead of time and try to keep you running when harvest gets here.
Fabricius says economists he's heard from think it could take 3 years for grain prices to recover. He hopes it won't be that long, but he thinks the risk of a crisis like farmers experienced in the 1980s is low, even though many of them owe money to the bank.
For the most part, you know, these guys are paying almost as low an interest rate as you can versus 15 or 18% back in the 80s.
And even though prices are low, farmers in the wheat belt do have a lot of grain to sell. Most of the few thousand bushels of wheat I have are in storage at Midland Marketing, a cooperative with 11 locations in north central Kansas. The main location sits right next to the Union Pacific Railroad's main line in Hays. The railroad is the main way to move grain from country elevators to markets. Travis Bruner is the commodities marketing manager at Midland. He's not impressed with my marketing strategy, which is to hold out until wheat gets back up to $10 a bushel, where it was in 2008.
You and a lot of other folks are, and I'm afraid that we won't see $10. Everything can be trumped by world events, but today we don't see any reason for wheat to make any major leaps towards the $7 or $8 mark.
Bruner says there are more than 2 billion bushels of wheat on the market currently. This year's crop fell short of the benchmark for protein content. That makes it less desirable for milling. And the strong dollar means U.S. wheat is more expensive to foreign buyers than supplies from other countries. Bruner says the absolute best price farmers could have locked in last year was about $4.50 a bushel.
If you look at it today, $4.50 looks like a home run, but $4.50 is not above break even in normal circumstances.
At current prices, the only way for most farmers to turn a profit this year is to sell lots of wheat. But the more they sell, the more downward pressure on prices. It could be a long slog. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Brian Thompson.
That story was produced by Heartland Health Monitor. In the kitchen at Rainbow Bakery, there are several ovens in one corner. There's a tall donut drying rack in the middle of the room. And then by the big window that looks out onto the sidewalk, that's where Lisa Dorozeski's prep station is.
Maybe third time I've made this. Because
ever?
Yeah, because we had such a short run of them last year.
She's an owner-operator of Rainbow Bakery, an all-vegan shop that makes donuts and cupcakes and lots of other baked goodies. She said this is maybe the third time she's made this peppered persimmon donut glaze, for sure the first time she's making it this year. Developing a recipe with persimmons was not easy.
I hadn't had much experience cooking with it, and I thought, oh, this will be great. Like, I'll just, like, reduce it, and it'll, like, be an excellent glaze, but it just, like, basically, like, almost seized up like chocolate, where you're just like thickens like crazy without putting like any thickening agent in it.
I guess it's thick just naturally. The pulp is really viscous.
Yeah, it has a lot of pectin in it, so it's like you can't reduce it the same way you could like reduce like strawberries or something.
So she uses straight persimmon pulp, which is naturally very sweet. The thing is, all their glazes contain a hefty amount of another very sweet ingredient, organic powdered sugar. She needed something to balance out that flavor.
What I did for that was I added black pepper to the recipe to kind of cut the sweet. Because there's no way around it. We have to use the sugar. Like, if I don't add powdered sugar to the recipe, then the glaze won't grab onto the donut in a way that would be pleasurable to eat. It would basically be like plopping applesauce on top of a donut or something. Maybe not that bad.
She makes the glazes in small portions, so this batch will last them 4 or 5 days.
So I'm going to go ahead and add about 1/2 cup of hot water. This is like from the hot water spigot. I feel like sometimes the spices might get muddled in all of this sugar mess, so I'm just going to like basically very lightly heat them up. So I'm adding a teaspoon of coriander, 1/2 teaspoon of black pepper. So I'm just gonna whisk this a little bit to get the spices incorporated. Okay, So now I'm going to add the persimmon pulp, about 3/4 cup. This, the recipes for glaze are pretty loose because you're really just going for the consistency that is appropriate. So like I wrote this recipe last year, but the persimmons are different than they were last year. So we might need to tweak it to find the correct consistency. So then I'm using a hand mixer and I'm mixing the water, spice, and persimmon together. So now I'm gonna add this, and this is organic evaporated cane juice powdered, AKA fancy powdered sugar.
You're adding a lot.
I'm shooting for around 6 cups, which sounds scary, but this is gonna feed, like, this is gonna yield so many donuts. It's spread out for a lot of humans, so don't worry about that. It tastes so much better than conventional powdered sugar, and like this is the only true vegan sugar because it's processed differently.
You can truly taste a difference?
Yeah, it's like it has more depth to it. It needs a little more powdered sugar. We want it to be like a little more opaque, and I can tell by looking at it that it's like not. It's gonna goop up more than I want it to. All right, this is pretty okay. We just got some clumps, so I'll work those out later.
Now to the donuts. They're cake donuts made with almond milk, sugar, oil, flour, and a dash of nutmeg. We'll get the glaze on these, and then there are 2 additional persimmon preparations that Lisa adds. So you're just plopping it in there.
Just plop it in there.
So I see now why you wanted it to be thicker.
Yeah. By nature, they are gooier than all of the other ones, but it'll drip down a little bit, but for the most part, it's sticking. So then I'm gonna plop, this is the reduced persimmon with coconut oil, and this is basically made with just like 1 cup of persimmon, 2 tablespoons of coconut oil, stirred nearly constantly on low heat until it thickens up to like pumpkin consistency. Yeah, I put it in a piping bag with a little star tip and just made a little burst. So then you can taste the persimmon very well in that. And then this is just the straight up persimmon pulp.
It's so pretty, 3 types of orange.
Yeah, they're very autumnal. The perfect autumnal donut.
Put this glaze on pancakes, on cookies, or if you're really going for it, drizzle it on Daniel Orr's persimmon pudding. Why not? Get yourself to the website to see the recipe and some pictures of Lisa Dorazeski in the Rainbow Bakery kitchen. It's at eartheats.org. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets. From gluten-free to kosher and halal. Food for everyone, everywhere. Full menu and truck location available at urgentfoods.com. And from Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington, independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Glad for your company today. I'm Annie Corrigan.